The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're taking a look at the math and science of the business world and the games they play. Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. Here with me is David McAdams. David is a professor of economics and professor of business administration at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. Before joining the faculty at Duke, he was associate professor of applied economics at MIT Sloan School of Management and has worked as special assistant to the director at the Bureau of Economics in the Federal Trade Commission. His primary research interests are microeconomic theory and game theory, with a special focus on strategic interactions between buyers and sellers. And his work has been published in leading economic journals. He's here today to talk about his recent book, Game Changer, Game Theory and the Art of Transforming Strategic Situations. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you.
Maybe let's start with a definition. What is game theory?
Well, let's start with a more basic definition of a game. When you say the word game, people think of amusements like Monopoly, or they might think of with a negative connotation of sort of a manipulation of someone for personal advantage. But what we mean when we say a game is really any strategic interaction. So any situation where there's multiple decision makers and the decisions that say I make impact you and your choices impact me. So the scope of game theory is enormous, covers just about everything where there's multiple decision makers. And game theory is simply, well, there's two sides to it, what I call the science of game theory and the art of game theory. The science of game theory is really a branch of applied mathematics that tries to understand strategic interactions mathematically. But the art of game theory, which is what my book Game Changer is about, it's a set of ideas that kind of enhance and complement common sense. So we're really, you know, taking mathematics and putting it to the service of intuition, brainstorming, to come up with new ideas to change the game and improve outcomes for everyone in difficult strategic situations.
You mentioned that game theory is a branch of mathematics. Obviously, mathematics is really logical and really rational. So does that necessarily mean that everything in game theory is really rational and logical?
No, absolutely not. We can study mathematical models where the assumption is that people make choices rationally, but you can also make assumptions that people behave irrationally. And a lot of economists these days are trying to have better models about how people really make decisions. And if we can do a better job of understanding how real decision making happens, we can do a better job of anticipating what's going to happen in games and also come up with better solutions to improve outcomes.
So obviously people have been thinking strategically for a really, really long time. But when did the idea of game theory as a discipline first come up?
Well, if you look back, for instance, in the context of military theory, so military contests and conflicts are definitely examples of games. And if you look back to, you know, some of the ancient writers like Sun Tzu, you see there a lot of the concepts of game theory. He didn't write them down mathematically, but in a systematic way, developing the concepts of strategy. And so you see game theory, the ideas of game theory going way back. Now, the notion of, you know, formalizing things mathematically is probably in the last 100, 150 years. But the key ideas of game theory aren't dependent on using mathematics. They really are things that you can understand without writing a single formula.
Now, in your book, you choose to focus almost exclusively on the prisoner's dilemma. Why did you make that decision?
There are many, many types of games. And I could have written a book where every chapter was a different type of game. You know, we could have had a chapter on coordination, which is a really important type of game, for instance. But I decided to focus on a game which poses a kind of a puzzle. So the classic story, which interestingly was sort of invented by the PhD advisor of this guy, John Nash. You know, have you seen the movie Beautiful Mind?
I have.
So Russell Crowe plays John Nash. And his PhD advisor, who has a bit part in the movie, came up with the game to illustrate an idea in game theory. So here's the game. You have two prisoners who are given a difficult choice. The lieutenant has put them in separate cells and tells them, look, I know you committed a crime, but I can't prove it. I want you to confess. If you're the only one to confess, I'll let you walk free. But if you're the only one not to confess, so if your partner confesses and you don't, you'll go to jail for life. Okay? But if you both confess, I'll send you to jail for a shorter period of time, maybe say 10 years. Now, put yourself in the shoes of this prisoner. If the prisoner believes that the other guy is going to confess, his choice is going to jail for life or 10 years. So he'll choose to confess, go to jail for 10 years. On the other hand, if he believes that his partner is not confessing, his choice is to confess and walk free or remain in jail for some period of time if neither one confesses. So no matter what the other guy does, you have an incentive yourself to confess. And in game theory, we call this a dominant strategy. So no matter what the other side does, you want to confess. But if both players do what's best for themselves individually, so if they both confess, they both go to jail for 10 years, for longer than if neither of them confess. So we have this this tension between individual freedom, if you will, so my freedom to do what's good for me and what's good for the group. So when everyone does what's best for them, everyone actually suffers. So this is an example where there can be too much liberty. And the name of the game, if you will, is figuring out a way to control that impulse and to get better outcomes for everyone. So can we find a way for neither of us to confess, to escape this trap? And what the book does is identifies five distinct ways to escape the prisoner's dilemma. And each of those five ways corresponds to a different principle of changing games. And that principle can be widely deployed in many other types of games. So the idea of the book is that if you really, really understand the prisoner's dilemma and all the ways to escape the prisoner's dilemma, then you're going to be able to be in a much better position when approaching any strategic situation, even those which are not prisoner's dilemmas.
So we're going to get into the escape routes in just a minute, but I also want to talk about the term game awareness, which is something you talk about quite a lot in the book. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is understanding the game you're in. A lot of times, we're not aware that we're playing games. If you look around you, you know, you'll realize that you're in a strategic interaction, say, with your spouse, with your children, with your colleagues, and we're often sort of blissfully unaware of the games that we're playing, and then disaster strikes. You know, you say something, and your colleague's offended, and all of a sudden, you have this horrible personal situation. If you had just thought about the situation ahead of time, if you had understood that it's a game, you could have avoided that disaster. And the book provides several sort of historical examples where someone just didn't realize the game they were playing, and because of it, they suffered a horrible outcome. On the other hand, if you are aware of the game you're in, you can make conscious efforts to improve it, to change the game for your personal advantage, or to help others.
So is there a trick to spotting games in kind of daily life, or do you just sort of have to be aware of what they look like?
You know, it's something you have to just practice. You know, like if you're a writer or a poet, you know, you're going to spend your time walking around making observations of the world and sort of internalizing those for your, you know, for your writing. If you're a game theorist, if you're a master of the art of game theory, you're going to spend your time looking around, seeing strategic situations, internalizing those, taking lessons from those. So, you know, it's about building a catalog of personal experiences that you can access. And the book, you know, gives you a jump start because, you know, I'm providing you with a few several dozen examples from history. So it's really a practice of developing game awareness.
You're listening to Science for the People, and today we're talking about game theory with David McAdams, professor of economics at the Duke Fuqua School of Business, and author of the new book, Game Changer, Game Theory and the Art of Transforming Strategic Situations. This book definitely reads like a practical guide. So let's talk about applications for a minute. Most of the time when we hear about game theory, we're talking about economics, or we're talking to someone in economics, like I am now. But what other types of people might be using game theory on a regular basis?
You know, it's really just a coincidence that game theory falls within economics, that the best game theorists in the world are mostly economists. Because as I mentioned, you know, you can use game theory in, you know, military strategy. Game theory is taught in the U.S. Military Academy. You can use game theory in all sorts of situations. So business strategy, one obvious one. Other business fields like marketing. You can also use game theory in medicine. Oh, and more broadly, evolution. So understanding Darwin's theories of, you know, selection. So these are there are implications of game theory. So, you know, for instance, with evolution, the animals that get the highest payoff in terms of reproductive success are those that are going to be present in the next generation. So you can use game theory to understand evolutionary outcomes. But, you know, because games are pervasive, they apply anywhere where decision makers interact, you can use them in a whole host of fields.
Okay, so let's drill into this a little bit more. If we're talking about a game, then obviously there are going to be moves, but there are different types of moves, right?
Yes. You need to understand the nature of the game, and there are several basic ways that games can differ, and I try to, you know, dig into that in the book. For instance, when you get experience looking at games and understanding them, you'll realize that a really important difference has to do with what I call the timing of moves. So do you make your decision without knowing what the other person has done? That's called simultaneous moves. Do you make your decision after seeing what the other person has done? That is called sequential moves. Are you able to make a commitment to how you will play the game? And I refer to that as commitment moves. So three basic different types of, if you will, timing of moves. Each type of game, depending on the timing of moves, very different. I mean, of course, games can also have, you know, many strategies or few strategies. They can be extremely complicated. How people feel about outcomes can depend on all sorts of things. So game theory is not about maximizing, you know, money. So money, for instance, is just one element of a, what we call a payoff. People often care about other things even more, you know, satisfaction, pride, jealousy. You know, these are all important elements to how we feel about outcomes. And they can be incorporated into what we call your payoff. And then we can use that to predict your behavior and also to make the best moves for ourselves.
Okay, so let's go through some examples of how to escape the prisoner's dilemma. I want to start with regulation. And one of the examples I found really fascinating in your book was about how the advertising ban affected cigarette companies.
Yeah, so it's back around 1970, Congress passed a law which stopped cigarette companies from advertising on television. It also added the Surgeon General's warning on cigarette packages. And one interesting thing I discovered when I started learning about this example is that advertising on television of cigarettes was actually a kind of strange thing back then. Normally, we think of advertising as promoting a product, so it kind of expands the market. But in this case, it turns out that advertising mainly served the function of trying to steal customers. So people are addicted to cigarettes. They're going to buy cigarettes. It's a question of which brand they're going to buy. And the television ads would basically be trying to, you know, steal business from each other. Another thing that happened just before Congress passed this law banning the advertisement is that the FCC did this public service campaign. So they rolled out a bunch of really famous television ads, and they required television stations to run one of these public service announcements every time there was a cigarette ad. So you have a 30-second cigarette ad, you then have a 30-second public service announcement saying how horrible cigarette smoking is right afterward. So it turned out that this was a prisoner's dilemma. The strategy or the choice that each cigarette company had was, do I run a television ad or not? Now, there's an individual incentive to run a television ad because you're going to be stealing customers from the other side. However, when you run that television ad, you also trigger the public service announcement. So people are actually going to be deciding to stop smoking. And these were very effective public service announcements. So all the cigarette companies had an individual incentive to advertise on television. But in so doing, they were funding this extremely effective public service campaign that was killing their business. So that's how it was a prisoner's dilemma. Ironically, all the cigarette companies would be better off not advertising on television. But because they were competing with each other, they kind of were stuck in this prisoner's dilemma trap. This is actually not hypothetical. The New York Times did an expose, and they discovered that actually the cigarette companies came up with the law. So the cigarette companies basically wrote the law that banned them from advertising on television. And not only that, in the year after the ban went into effect, the profits went up 30%, while their advertising went down about 30% relative to the year before. So a sudden dramatic increase in their profitability, and also, some would argue, a drop in the rate of decline of cigarette smoking. So if this public service campaign had continued, fewer people would have been smoking, And the irony, though, was that although cigarette companies were behind it, they stayed behind the scenes, because if they announced that they wanted it, of course, it wouldn't happen. The actual main driver of this law was the FCC itself, which was aggressively fighting against cigarette smoking. So and the FCC commissioner just misunderstood the game. He thought that by banning TV ads, he would decrease smoking. He didn't understand the nature of the game. And so that's kind of the tragedy of this thing. Is this guy, Commissioner Hyde, he pushed for this law, and in so doing, he undermined his work. So, backing up into how to escape the prisoner's dilemma, this was a very creative way for the cigarette companies to escape their prisoner's dilemma, and they did it through regulation. And the idea of regulation is you get someone, the regulator, to come in and basically not allow you to play your dominant strategy.
This is really fascinating. Something that everybody really thinks was a regulation move by the government was to some extent supported by and the idea came from the cigarette industry, or did the idea come from the regulators and the cigarette industry went, yes, that's a good idea?
I don't want to overstate. I haven't read all the original source documents, but the cigarette companies wanted this law to pass.
Wow.
And I have the site. You can go read the New York Times article yourself that uncovers that. And their profits went up. So, you know, the proof is in the pudding, too. They had a dramatic leap in their profitability. And if you go to people who were children during that period in, 1967, 1970, they remember those ads. I mean, like, there's this one really classic one called Like Father, Like Son. And the ad basically has, it's a cute little ad where the boy is copying everything his dad does, like driving the car and, you know, mowing the lawn or whatever. And then the dad sits down and lights up a cigarette, and the little kid reaches into his pocket and grabs a cigarette. So, you know, that was a really poignant, advertisement that would tell parents, hey, look, your kid's going to start smoking because you are. And so that convinced a lot of people to stop smoking. But those public service announcements stopped in 1970.
So do we know if their profits went up because more people started smoking, or did their profits go up simply because they didn't have to expend as much money on marketing?
Their profits went up even more than their advertising expenditures went down. So what that means is their revenue went up. So their sales either increased or they raised the price that they were able to charge. It sounds paradoxical, but if there's fewer advertisements, say for Marlboro Man, then people who are smoking Camels have less reason to think about switching. So you would expect actually Marlboro and Camel to both raise their prices and have less switching. So advertising can actually increase competition by raising awareness in customers of different options. So advertising can harm firms, but and in the same way, stopping advertising, you know, if you're smoking Marlboros, you just keep smoking Marlboros.
Okay, moving on to something a bit more inspiring. Could you talk about the Eliminating Neglected Diseases Amendment? Maybe give us a little backstory on that game and how regulation made a change there.
Yes, this is another example of regulation, although it's not actually solving a prisoner's dilemma, but if it's such a compelling story, I included it. So we have these neglected diseases like, you know, malaria and several others, where pharmaceutical companies really don't have that much incentive to develop new drugs because there's just not a lot of money in it. So the brilliant idea, actually one of my colleagues, David Ridley, here at Duke, he came up with this idea and published it. And a congressman actually read it, actually Senator Brownback, I think, read it and was convinced and pushed through this law. So here's a law that you can actually credit economists for giving you. So what it did, incredibly creative idea. So imagine you're a pharmaceutical company. You'd have no interest in really developing a drug for malaria, but you do have this cholesterol drug or this like some other drug which has a huge potential market, but it's sitting in line at the FDA. For review, because you need the FDA to give the okay. And while they're doing their review, you know, your patent is sort of dwindling. And so the idea is that if this drug company were to also develop a treatment for some neglected disease that can save millions and millions of lives, then we're going to let your cholesterol drug skip to the front of the line. You're going to be able to sell that cholesterol drug for several additional months or maybe an additional year and make many, many, many millions more off of the cholesterol drug. So this is a really creative idea to recognize that your place in line is a valuable asset. And before the law, you know, people were just sitting, wasting time there. Now you give an incentive to do something that benefits the world in order to jump ahead in line.
How effective has this been?
Well, you know, it takes a long time to develop drugs, so it's not much of a surprise that there really haven't been many drugs yet. It's only been, 7 years since the amendment was passed. However, there is a pipeline of neglected disease drugs coming online that should qualify for priority review vouchers. That's what they call them. And, you know, one that I highlight in the book is by this company called Nanovirucides, and they're this very small company run basically on a shoestring, but they're developing a novel approach to use basically little nano machines in your blood to trick viruses into attaching to them. And once the virus attaches to the little machine, it unfolds and basically stabs them to death. And that's actually the way it works. And there are millions of them floating around your blood. So this concept can be used for basically any type of viral disease in your blood. And so they could have chosen to do anything. And they had a press release just a few days ago announcing they're advancing to initial human trials in their first two drugs. One of them is a flu, and the other is dengue fever. And dengue fever is a disease that afflicts, you know, many, many millions of people in the developing world, and there's really no effective treatment. So they would never, my point is that Nanovirucides would never have chosen dengue fever as one of its first two drugs and spent the money to do the trials if there wasn't the promise of a priority review voucher that they could then sell to another company, like, you know, GlaxoSmithKline or something, for advancing some blockbuster drug.
So they don't even have to necessarily use these priority vouchers themselves. They can sell it to another company?
No. Yeah, that's the whole point. You can sell it. So there could be specialist companies that just do this.
Wow.
So this is giving an incentive for existing pharma companies to allow their scientists to pursue these very important neglected diseases, but also creating an opportunity for new players to enter the game.
And for big players with deep pockets, these priority vouchers, I'm assuming, would be pretty valuable.
It could be. It's very speculative how valuable they are. We'll just have to wait and see until there's enough of them for us to say. There has been a priority review voucher assigned, but it was for a drug that actually did not have much impact. And the particular voucher, this was for the anti-malarial drug Coartem. So it had very little real-world impact, and also turned out not to be very valuable because Novartis used it on a drug that was ultimately rejected. So we'll have to wait and see just how valuable they are. But in principle, they could be very valuable, and hopefully that's going to turn out to be true. And many millions of people can have their lives saved because of it.
That is definitely one that I'm going to keep my eye on. This next one is interesting. The idea that cartels aren't always bad. So let's talk about diamonds, sir.
Diamonds are not forever is the name of the little example. Diamonds have an important symbolic role in relationships. They're not just, you know, sparkly little rocks that you adorn yourself with. They're a symbol of your eternal love and commitment. Are you married, Michelle?
I am not.
Okay, well, imagine that a man proposed to you and you got a diamond and this guy was pretty wealthy and he gave you a huge rock and, you know, it cost $10,000. And the next year, it only cost $5,000. How would you feel?
I'd feel a little bit ripped off.
You'd say, like, what? We spent our money on that. It's not worth as much. Or you might think, hey, this is only worth half of what it is. Maybe my marriage is only worth half of what it was. So, it's really, really important for the price of diamonds not to be volatile. And if you look at a graph of diamond prices over time, they were extremely volatile early on before this company, De Beers, took basically total control of the industry. But once they took total control of the industry, prices became extraordinarily steady. So slightly rising over time, but extraordinarily steady. And that's a really important property of diamonds. People assume that a diamond is valuable. In fact, there are humongous piles of diamonds just sitting around. There is an enormous glut. Diamonds are not inherently valuable, okay? They are valuable because we feel they are valuable, and there are players out there restricting the supply of diamonds. So, but what's happening is that De Beers is splintering. It's no longer the major player it was. It was like the market share is like half of what it used to be. They're not a monopolist anymore. They're actually entering into the retail business. So there's no one out there anymore who has the capability to keep supplies constant, to keep the price steady. No, so if something happens, like if people in China just fall in love with diamonds and start buying them up, okay, the price may skyrocket. Or alternatively, if synthetic diamonds, which are actually a major development, they're able to make diamonds in the lab. Okay, so if the processes of making synthetic diamond improve to the point that you can make things that look like a beautiful natural stone very cheaply, the price could drop. So there'll be no one out there to battle that trend. So there will be a point in time where the price in diamonds, because something happens in the world, changes suddenly, and then people are going to get a rude awakening. Diamonds are not a store of value. They're not a symbol of eternal love. And once that happens, people are going to stop buying diamond engagement rings. So that's my sort of prediction. They're going to move to something else, symbolize their love. And all because the cartel no longer exists. We can thank the De Beers monopoly, so they're the cartel, for creating this wonderful thing, the diamond engagement ring, that so many people have enjoyed. Without them, we wouldn't have the diamond engagement ring. I mean, it wouldn't be the institution it is today.
Did De Beers also potentially create the role, or sorry, the symbolic identity for the diamond as well as part of their work as a monopoly? Did they create the demand as much as they
did everything?
The flow?
No, they did everything, Rochelle. So De Beers, when they came, so they learned the hard way about the fickleness of demand for diamonds. So when they moved to the United States, they entered into an exclusive marketing relationship with this legendary company called N.W. Ayer. And what Ayer did was they crafted a plan to raise awareness of diamonds. So they paid movie stars to wear them. They created this concept that a diamond is forever. That was De Beers' tagline. They cultivated that and continued saying that over and over again for decades. Not only that, De Beers basically invented the way that we evaluate the quality of diamonds. If you ask your friends, if your friend gets married and you say, "Oh, tell me about your diamond," they'll probably tell you about its size, the carat, but they may also tell you about its so-called clarity, its color, these characteristics of the diamond. De Beers invented those. And the reason they invented them was there was a huge discovery of very small diamonds in the Soviet Union, okay, so several decades ago. Prior to that discovery, De Beers had been running ads saying, "Hey, you need a really, really big rock to show how much your man loves you." And these were incredibly internally flawed. Like, which are just huge rocks. That was the. But then when they discovered all these small diamonds, like, what are they going to do with these small diamonds? They changed their tune and said, "Hey, you need a flawless diamond to symbolize the flawlessness of your love." But it was just to unload those rocks. Okay, so they have created this entire market and completely shaped the way that we think about diamonds.
Wow, very clever management there.
That's another example of game awareness. Understanding that diamonds are not about providing a sparkling rock. They're about enhancing a relationship, a love relationship between a man and a woman. Understanding that, having that game awareness allowed De Beers to create a game that has been enormously profitable for them for decades.
So I'm just sort of speculating here. If the prices of diamonds continue to be volatile and go up and down, and their symbolic value will likely go down, is I think what we're getting from this. Will their utilitarian value probably stay constant? Because obviously there's diamonds have fairly utilitarian uses in things like tools.
Absolutely. So they're used for all sorts of things, grinding, cutting, reflecting light. They're also really useful for all sorts of monitors. So like they're very resistant to chemicals. So they have all sorts of industrial uses. People are even talking about making, you know, replacement body parts, like, you know, knees out of diamond. They're very flat. They're useful in all sorts of ways. And so they're also sparkly. And so they look nice. So, you know, so there will still be a market for diamonds. It's just I'm talking about diamond engagement rings.
It'll be interesting to see if, as their symbolic value goes down, if maybe they become priced at a point where they're it's more financially feasible to use them in some of these other ways.
No, absolutely, and I'm personally fascinated by the synthetic diamonds. You know, the developments there. So once you can start cranking out high quality diamonds, it's going to possibly create a whole bunch of industrial uses.
You are tuned in to Science for the People, and we'll be right back with David McAdams after the break to talk more about game theory.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm here with David McAdams, professor of economics, to talk about his new book on game theory, Game Changer, Game Theory and the Art of Transforming Strategic Situations. So I also want to talk about the Department of Justice and how they use strategic thinking in guaranteeing amnesty in antitrust cases. What's going on there?
So we're talking about collusion among firms, and collusion is actually widespread. One thing that's important to understand is that a lot of collusion between firms happens without the awareness of top management. So I want to just sort of paint you a picture of what the game is, and then I'll talk about how the Department of Justice changed the game. So you'll have a set of firms operating in an industry. So a really famous one was actually in the vitamin industry, bulk vitamins. So creating the vitamins they feed to animals and they put in your cereal box. So managers, mid-level managers in these firms, got together and decided that they didn't want to compete. They would all be better off if they could agree to split the market and raise prices, because then, you know, their division's revenues would go up and they'd get promoted or whatever. Okay, so they're colluding. Now, what happens if one of the firms in this cartel discovers this illegal behavior? You know, if the legal department of one of these firms found out they were breaking the law, well, they're not going to go tell the police, right? They're just going to shut it down, keep everything quiet. Okay, so for that reason, the Department of Justice, which is basically the police here, rarely caught business cartels. In fact, in the 1980s, they did not catch a single major cartel or a single international business cartel. But in 1993, something changed. They, you know, they're sitting on their hands saying, hey, I'm not catching any cartels. My job is to catch cartels. I haven't caught a single cartel in over 10 years. Let's change the way we do things. And they got an idea, actually, from game theory, from strategic thinking, which was that, well, the reason they're not telling me about it is they're afraid they're going to go to jail or they're going to get fined. So why don't we guarantee that the first firm in a cartel that comes to us will get absolute guaranteed amnesty. No matter what they did, their firm will not be fined. No one in their firm will go to jail, nothing, okay? So now we go back to our game. We have our, you know, mid-level executives who are colluding, and then the legal department in one of the firms discovers, oh my gosh, we've been breaking the law. Well, now what do? You could try to keep it quiet, but then you risk going to jail. Okay, so now the firm, whereas before the firm sort of had a dominant strategy, if you will, not to confess, now they have a dominant strategy to confess and do it right away. Because you don't want to be the second person to confess. There's no amnesty for the second person. You go to jail for the second person. So as soon as you find out that cartel behavior is happening, the firm has a very strong incentive to immediately go to the Department of Justice. Anticipating that, you know, the whole thing starts unraveling. So you don't want to be the second, so you may actually go first. So cartels have been transformed from very stable entities with a very low risk of detection to very unstable things, which are very likely. We don't know how likely they are to be detected because you only see the ones that you see, but they're much more likely to be detected. The government is making many millions of dollars every year off of fines on cartels that are caught, and they continue to be caught every year in and year out now. So this has been a very effective program. It's called the Corporate Leniency Program, and it's really sort of opened the floodgates in terms of catching cartels.
This is really interesting because what I didn't really realize that it was quite often not the higher ups in management who were running these cartels or behind these cartels, but it's the people kind of underneath them. So it's this upper management that this legislation is really targeting.
You know, a big theme that I you know, get to in many of the examples in the book is that we often misunderstand who the players really are. And this is an important aspect of game awareness. So it's natural to say, okay, Hoffman LaRoche is the player. Okay, they're a company that was in this vitamin scandal. But really, there are individuals within that organization, and they have their own incentives. So the real game might be, well, there's a mid-level executive who wants to pump up his revenue numbers, but there's also a top executive who just wants to, you know, have a profitable business. They don't want to break the law. That would be dumb. So understanding and harnessing that game and using it to your advantage is sort of that's my take on what's really going on in the corporate leniency program. There's also an individual leniency program as well. So if somehow a firm made the choice not to go to the DOJ, and any individual within that firm can go on their own, and that individual will then get leniency, and the firm will just get, you know, thrown in the fire. So because there's that individual leniency as well, the firm now has even more incentive to confess, because they're not quite sure if someone in their firm is going to go tell.
We're running out of time, but I want to squeeze one more in here because I think it's really important for us to think about. I want to talk about the case study used in the book regarding addicts going to emergency rooms for prescriptions. So maybe walk us through what's going on there.
Right. So some of the most important examples that I sort of dug into in the book are in the realm of medicine. So I talk about antibiotic resistance. And I'm very proud of that work. But also there's this example which strikes close to home, which is emergency departments. So, you know, when you're having a health crisis, you go to the emergency room. And, you know, in a lot of emergency rooms, you're waiting a long time. And part of the reason for that wait is that there are people going to this emergency room just to get narcotics. People who are in pain need narcotic opioids, they're called, to treat their pain, but one can easily become dependent on these drugs. And those who become dependent or addicted, they then have an incentive to use more drugs than they get from their own pain management specialist. So they then go to the emergency room and try to get extra. And so this creates a real problem for the emergency physicians, since refusing these drugs will, you know, cause a lot of delay. These people can be very get angry, and they can sort of not. They say, "Look, I won't leave until you give me drugs." But also, if you refuse someone, they can give you a negative patient satisfaction score. And it turns out that emergency physicians are rated, and their pay is based on their. They can be fired for getting poor patient satisfaction scores. I mean, think about it. This is the emergency room. You save someone's life, okay, or they die. Does it really matter how satisfied they were? But nonetheless, that's how people's, you know, careers are determined there. So they have a strong incentive. It's actually, you can think of it like a prisoner's dilemma. You have an incentive to prescribe these narcotics even when you're fairly sure that it's not the best thing for the patient.
So what is the potential escape?
So it's kind of obvious. You just got to change how you're incentivizing these doctors. Instead of punishing someone, so every time one of these emergency physician gets a negative score, they're basically brought to the office and scolded. They're like, "Don't do that again." And I've talked to many emergency physicians, so this is the way it works. So instead of that, what should happen is that when a person comes in seeking narcotics, and they're flagged as someone who is, so they call them frequent flyers. So if they're flagged as someone who is doing this inappropriately, then you should reward that doctor. You shouldn't punish them, okay? But it turns out that, you know, hospital administrators understand this, but it turns out that if your doctors get negative scores, the hospital or the emergency department itself can be punished financially and reputationally. So there are these rankings. So just like colleges are ranked, and, you know, we had some scandals in the last couple of years where colleges were falsifying, like, SAT scores and stuff, or they were admitting people with high SAT scores to bump up their ratings. In the same way, here in emergency departments, there's an incentive to, even if it's inappropriate, to provide treatment that leads to positive scores. So my call for leadership, if you will, in the chapter is hospital leadership needs to recognize this is an important problem. People are dying every day because of these inappropriate practices in the emergency department. Hospital leadership needs to change the way that they incentivize doctors in the emergency room. If they do that, it's just the right thing to do. And they need to go against the incentive and do what's right. And those who are evaluating hospitals, the ranking companies, Medicare and others, they need to change the way that they evaluate and rank hospitals and actually reward hospitals for doing the right thing and saving lives.
This is really interesting because I had never really heard of this kind of customer satisfaction score given to hospitals in the U.S. Of course, I'm up here in Canada, and our medicine is sort of government run. It's all public. Right. So we don't have the same kind of system. Do you think this might be sort of a bit of a problematic or flaw with the privatized system versus the public system in some ways?
When all hospitals are chasing a higher ranking, You can think of that as a form of competition, and it's a harmful form of competition potentially if it causes these hospitals to do things that aren't in the benefit of the patient. Now, of course, on the other hand, there's lots of good things about patient satisfaction. It's been documented that nurses do a better job of taking your blood, so the venipuncture, they call it. So if your nurse doesn't care how satisfied you are, they may just poke you, okay? And that increases your stress level, increases your pain level, actually harms your care. But if they know that it behooves them to have you feel comfortable, they'll come in, they'll talk to you, they'll calm you down, they'll pick a vein real carefully. You know, so that has improved. So that's been documented. So some aspects of clinical care are improved when patient satisfaction matters. The trick is figuring out which aspects of patient satisfaction to use when incentivizing hospitals. I mean, competition is a great thing. So, you know, there are many advantages to a system where there is competition in provision of healthcare. But on the other hand, competition can also be harmful. And we just need to figure out ways to minimize the harm and maximize the benefit.
It sounds like one of those situations where it really could go either way. And it sounds like if this patient satisfaction score was applied in very specific areas of medicine, it could be really helpful. But there are areas that really, like you say, like in the ER, what you really care about is whether or not people's lives are being saved, not necessarily if they were satisfied with the service you provided while they were not dying.
Exactly. And let me just say one more thing about this patient satisfaction, because here we have a game that is not being fully realized. And it's the game between the patient and the provider. So right now, there is very limited communication between doctors and their patients. I mean, we get these satisfaction surveys 3 days after we go home, basically, in the mail. I mean, they do some email ones too, but basically there's a rule that they can't ask you how you like it while it's happening. They have to wait until later, and that's because they don't want the doctors to try to influence you in what you say. But because of that separation, there's really no relationship. There's an opportunity to build a relationship and have communication between the patients and the doctors to improve the quality of care and also to customize care in important ways. And that's really not being exploited at all. So there's huge possibilities to recognize there is a game here between patients and their doctors and nurses, and to improve that game. And patient satisfaction is one element of building a relationship, and it's just not being used right now to its full potential.
David, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. It's been fun.
If you want to learn more about David McAdams, his book, Game Changer, Game Theory and the Art of Transforming Strategic Situations, or game theory in general, you can start on his website, gamechangerfiles.com, and we'll make sure that link goes into our show notes for this episode at scienceforthepeople.ca.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're talking about science and evidence in the political process. We'll talk to Dan Cahan, professor of law and psychology at Yale Law School, about the Cultural Cognition Project, which studies group values and perceptions of risk in science communication. We'll speak to Shane Trimmer, executive director of Franklin's List, about their work to elect pro-science candidates. And biologist Katie Gibbs returns with an update on Evidence for Democracy, which advocates for the transparent use of evidence in Canadian government policy. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. With me is Professor Benjamin Ho, a behavioral economist who uses tools like game theory and experiments to understand social systems such as apologies, identity, and climate concerns. He's currently an assistant professor at Vassar College and has also taught at Columbia and Cornell. He received his PhD in economics from Stanford GSB and holds master's degrees in computing science, political science, and comparative education from MIT and Stanford. He was also the lead energy economist on the White House Council of Economic Advisors and has worked and consulted for Morgan Stanley and several tech startups. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, and thanks for the very generous introduction.
So just to start, maybe give us a quick look into what a behavioral economist does, since I'm not sure many of our listeners are familiar with that job title.
Sure. The area of economics has a few other names. I think the best one is like psychological economics or economics and psychology. And the basic idea is to use traditional economic tools like game theory and like experimental economics to look at things that have traditionally been the purview of psychologists, like altruism or fairness, or in my case, trust and apologies.
Okay, so before we get into your work specifically, I'm curious, how did you get interested in researching the economics of apologies?
You know, I got to grad school interested in sort of saving the world and looking at the big picture questions of economics. And I realized that those are just really hard questions that a lot of smart people have tackled already. And so I became interested in using behavioral economics to sort of look at, you know, things that we could sort of study in a laboratory and things that we could sort of get a better grip on. And so at some point in graduate school, my roommate came to me with this dilemma. He had this friend that kept making appointments to play tennis. And every week, you know, he would show up and she would show up late and apologize profusely and then come back the next week and she would show up late again and apologize profusely. So my roommate came to me and said, Ben, you know, these apologies, they're just empty words. You know, why do we even bother with apologies? And so I thought, you know, sat back and thought about it a bit and thought, oh, well, you know, you can actually write down a mathematical model of how apologies work. And that's what I set out to do.
Okay, so as part of your research, you looked at apologies, quote unquote, in the real world, including examples from both corporate America and from the world of medicine. So let's start with corporate America. What did you look into there?
So the corporate apologies, I was sort of relying on other people's research. So there was some nice research by Laura Tiedens and a couple of her collaborators that looked at, you know, how do firms use apologies? Specifically, she looked at their annual reports every year to look at how did corporations explain their earnings from the past year, especially in years when they had poor earnings. And one thing she found was that firms that, you know, were sort of more apologetic and took personal responsibility for their earnings actually were rewarded by this by the stock market in the following year. Whereas firms that sort of made excuses or didn't were less apologetic, you know, basically had lower stock prices in the following year. You know, and that was evidence that inspired me to look into, you know, are there better ways to study apologies? Because, you know, in her data, it's a correlation, it's correlational evidence. It's hard to say that the apologies itself was responsible for the stock price changes. So I sort of looked into ways to sort of, you know, generate a more causal story beyond just the correlations that Laura Tiedens found.
This is something that always fascinates me about economics. It seems like there's a lot of correlative studies out there, but it's really difficult to determine causation in these kinds of things.
Yeah, causation is something that actually economists are very obsessed with, I think more so than other fields. My wife is in medicine, and there, I think a lot of the trouble with medical studies is that a lot of those studies are based on correlations, which is why one week eggs are good for you, the next week eggs are bad for you, because correlational studies have a lot of inherent flaws. And so, you know, we as economists, we spend a lot of time looking for tricks to try to, you know, tease out causation from correlation, because that evidence tends to be a lot more solid.
You also looked at data surrounding legislation that makes doctors' apologies inadmissible in court. So talk me through that research.
Right. So this was an attempt to sort of get at a causal impact of apologies. And we got at that by sort of looking at the causal effect of what are called apology laws. So an apology law is basically premised on two stylized facts. The first is that doctors are often just scared to apologize because they're worried that, you know, by apologizing, they're just going to, you know, encourage the patients to sue by giving them more, you know, more information about their own mistakes. But at the same time, if you look at surveys with patients, you find that the main reasons patients usually sue their doctors is because they're angry and maybe because they never received an apology. And so you sort of get this vicious cycle where doctors are afraid to apologize and patients, you know, often just want an apology or otherwise they sue. So basically, to sort of fix this, a lot of states, you know, 36 at the time of of my research and more now, have passed laws that say that if a doctor apologizes to a patient, that apology can't be used in a court of law. And so using some, you know, econometric and statistic techniques, we tried to sort of tease out what's the impact of these apology laws on litigation rates in various states.
So how do we know that this might be, or what is the evidence that suggests this is more of a causal link rather than a correlative link?
So you're always worried that, you know, maybe something else was going on in the state when they passed the law that also led to the decrease in litigation for other reasons. And so we looked for that, right? So we looked to see whether the apology laws are correlated with other malpractice reform legislation. And we found, you know, very little correlation. We also looked for evidence to see if these apology laws were linked to maybe political shifts in the state. And it wasn't linked to that as well. So we're pretty confident that these apology laws tended to occur for reasons that are not related to, you know, sort of systematic thing, the other things that might affect rates of medical malpractice. So, you know, so we, in our paper, we sort of argue that it's the laws themselves that cause these shifts in malpractice and not something else.
It's interesting that you mentioned politics. Politics and politicians are sort of the notorious people who never apologize. Has there been any studies or any data produced on apologies in politics?
Political economy is actually one of the areas that got me interested in this study of apologies. You see political apologies both at the sort of institutional level with countries deciding whether to apologize or not, whether it's South Africa apologizing for apartheid or the United States apologizing for Japanese internment or slavery. There's also this sort of general stylized fact about politicians just generally don't apologize, whether it's Bill Clinton for his the Monica Lewinsky affair, or it's George Bush for various missteps during his presidency. So looking at this, Laura Tiedens, who I mentioned earlier, she has an experiment where she generated two different videos of Bill Clinton talking about the Monica Lewinsky affair. In one video, Clinton sounds apologetic and sounds like he's genuinely sorry. And in the other video, Clinton just sounds angry about the Lewinsky affair and angry that he's been accused. And what she did was she showed these videos to two different groups of people. And what she found was the group that saw apologetic Clinton wound up liking Clinton more, but the group that saw angry Clinton wound up liking Clinton less, showing that apologies do indeed work. However, the interesting thing was that the group that saw apologetic Clinton thought he was a weaker person, a weaker president, and were actually, in fact, less likely to want to vote for him as president again, suggesting that apologies have a real cost. Right, so that, you know, I think the premise of my mathematical model of apologies is that apologies definitely work to make people like you more, but they only work if there is some real cost that befalls you.
You're listening to Science for the People. I'm here with Ben Ho, assistant professor of economics at Vassar College, and we're talking about the strategic side of apologizing. Now, you actually built an experiment out to test some of your ideas around the economics of apologies. Can you walk us through that?
You know, again, toward this separating causality from correlation, one great way to do that is to, you know, do an randomized controlled experiment where you could randomly assign people to different treatment groups and see how they behave. So in order to do this, I had an experimental lab. This is back as a graduate student. And what I did was I brought students into a laboratory where they play what's called the trust game. So the trust game is a game that experimental economics uses a lot, where there's two players in the game. One player is the investor and one player is the entrepreneur. The investor is given some amount of money. This is real money. Economic experiments always use real money. In our case, this was $20. And the investor could choose to invest some or all of the money into the entrepreneur's project. If the investor does so, the money multiplies, assuming that there's some kind of gains from trade where investment leads to sort of more output. So now the entrepreneur has the investor's money plus, you know, plus some, and the entrepreneur can just choose to either run away with it or return part of it. So this is a standard game to sort of measure trust and whether the investor trusts the entrepreneur. What I added to this game was the players repeated their interaction over and over again. And between each interaction, if the entrepreneur did not generate good returns for the investor, the entrepreneur can apologize. And this experiment was all designed to sort of test the main predictions of the theory of apologies I generated. Of the theoretical results we tested, there were things like you should see more apologies in long relationships, you should see more apologies in better matched relationships, you should see more apologies early in relationships, and all those predictions of the mathematical theory were borne out by the experimental data.
So based on your research, both looking at data other people have collected and some of the experience you ran, what makes a good apology?
The basic premise of my theory of apologies is based on this idea that sort of came from biology, but has been extended into economics, and that's signaling theory. The idea of signaling theory is that if you want to sort of communicate something about yourself, the most effective way to signal that is by doing something that's costly to fake. The best example from biology for this is peacock feathers, which are these extravagant plumages that peacocks use to sort of show that they're a strong mate, even though the feathers themselves are useless. The traditional application in economics is education, where one reason for getting an education is just to sort of signal how smart you are, and it's that signaling value of education that's almost more important than what you actually learn. So when you apply that model to like apologies, what we find is that the apologies that are most effective are the ones that are sort of most costly or the costliest to fake. We sort of look at a few different categories of apologies. One is, I'm sorry about your grandmother's illness. This is the kind of apology where you're not really admitting any mistake in yourself. You're only demonstrating that you have empathy for the other person. This is in some ways the easiest apology because it has very little cost on yourself. And as a result, it's often sort of the least effective. Other apologies we look at is, I'm sorry, I will never do it again. This is I think of this apology as a kind of a contract where by apologizing now, you're promising to higher standards of behavior in the future. And this has a cost because in the future, if I screw up again, that apology means I'll be punished even more for it the second time. The third class of apologies that I sort of look at is, I'm sorry, I'm an idiot apologies. This is sort of like the Bill Clinton example where you apologize by basically admitting that you're, a not very competent person. So in the case of Bill Clinton, the apology about the affair made him a more likable person, but made voters feel that he was less competent. Two other kinds of apologies. One is, I'm sorry, here are some flowers, which is just, I'm going to buy something expensive, like flowers or a big diamond ring, to apologize. The more costly, the more effective. And then probably the least effective apology is just, I'm sorry, it wasn't my fault. This is often called the non-apology apology, because you're really, accepting no blame on yourself. You're paying little cost. And that's why these are often the least effective in changing people's opinions.
So I want to go back to corporations for a second, because when corporations are perceived to have done a wrong and they choose to apologize or not apologize, there's often a lot of intense scrutiny about this decision in the media, now on social media. People talk about it a lot. They either demand an apology or an apology is not good enough. I'm interested if your research has told you anything about strategically as a corporation, is it always better to apologize or are there risks to apologizing?
There are definitely risks to apologizing, but I think the key part of my research is to show that those risks are the crucial component that makes the apology worthwhile, right? So if you sort of use an apology that, weasel words, sort of the classic non-apology apology to minimize risks to the company, those are the apologies that are perceived as, sort of the most useless. And those are the ones that are sort of often rightly criticized the most, because you're not really putting yourself out there. You're not putting yourself at risk. It's really the apologies that sort of accept blame, that open yourself up for future litigation and future lawsuits, that really, put your reputation on the line. Those are actually the best apologies in terms of, shifting public opinion toward your favor. But, but at the same time, if I were advising a corporation, I'd have to say, these apologies have real costs, and you need to really, weigh those costs and benefits when you're trying to decide how to respond to these crises.
It really sounds like sometimes the strategy of apologies becomes a weight between short-term negatives and potentially long-term gains.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the research. So the game theoretic models we looked at, one of the predictions was that an apology is most effective early in a relationship when people are still uncertain about each other and are still sort of feeling each other out. And also that apologies are most effective in long relationships. If the encounter is just, a taxi driver where you're only going to see him once, then the you're less likely to see apologies because it's less meaningful. But if it's an ongoing relationship that you'll sort of, extend for a very long time, then you could think of the apology as an investment for the future.
So what's the next step? What open questions do you still have that you'd like to explore?
There's a few next steps. One is that I'm curious about apologies and corporate culture. I think there's some evidence out there in the literature about how different countries have different standards of apologies. I think a typical one is comparing, say, Japan and the United States, where in Japan people apologize a lot more. I'm curious about how that applies to different corporations. Are there some corporations that are more prone to having apologies? Are there some that are less? Sort of the mathematical theory predicts that companies or organizations that value relationships more, you should see more apologies, whereas companies where it's more about individual achievement rather than team achievement, you should see fewer apologies. And whether this tells us something about sort of the best, you know, sort of corporate hiring practices and the types of people you see at different corporations.
Ben, thanks so much for being here. You have a very interesting job.
I love it.
If you want to learn more about Ben Ho and his work on the economics of apologies, you can find the links to get you started on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And since you're there, do also click the links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and our Google Plus page to keep up with the latest news from the show. On our website, you can also download and listen to all our past episodes, leave a comment with your thoughts on this show, or send us some feedback. You can also click over to us on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show and, if so inclined, leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Science for the People.